From the Mutual Broadcasting System, this is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, and I'm going to talk about something that I think needs to be kind of, I know I've alluded to it many times, but I'm going to talk about the issue, which is probably best summed up as Putin's predicament. And the reason I bring this up is because the president's envoy, Steve Witkoff, met with Putin. There's talk about the president, President Trump meeting with Putin. I have no idea where they're going to meet because there's an international criminal court warrant out for Putin's arrest, which basically takes a number of potential meeting places off the table. So a lot of going on there, but the talk is, can they get a peace deal or a ceasefire with Putin? And there are some things that I think all of us need to be aware of that are running in the background that may make us a little less optimistic. One thing I want to point out, without the threat of secondary tariffs to India and China, Russia's oil sales dropped 27%, more than a quarter than where they were a year ago. That's a significant drop. And the price of oil, the price that Russia is able to charge, has also dropped considerably, well below the cap. The EU sanctions, the European Union sanctions, the flexible price caps, all of this without the secondary tariffs are cutting into Russia's revenue picture. And that's causing them great problems. That's more their sovereign fund, their piggy bank, if you will, their savings that they have to dip into, which are darn near depleted right now, that they're using to pay for the war. Now, Trump is targeting India, specifically with tariffs over Russian oil imports. He just announced that it's going up to 50%. Well, you got to read the fine print. It didn't like instantly go to 50%. He just said that. He was already saying he was going to do tariffs, but it could have gone theoretically Friday when the deadline, this week when the deadline was due. It could have actually gone up to 100%, but he's talking about 50%. Look, 50% tariffs on Indian goods being exported to the U.S., that would literally, I don't know if it completely shut down exports to the U.S., but it would be a horrific thing. And the other thing, too, is that India kind of did an in-your-face thing, which I understand. You know, India has a lot of pride, a lot of national pride. They don't like being bullied. They've got a long history of not liking being bullied. They've always been kind of independent. They've always gone their sort of third way, as they call it, in international politics. That goes all the way back to the beginning of India when they became an independent country from Britain back in the mid-1940s, 47. So they've always been very independent in that regard. And they basically pushed back and they said, look, we're going to keep buying oil and gas from Russia. And that appears to have really kind of set off President Trump. He's always had a pretty good relationship with Modi, but he's been playing hardball with Modi. And Modi has to respond to political pressures in India, in his country, just like we do here. And so he pushed back. Well, that's the result, is this 50% tariff threat that can kick in probably within 3 weeks. So there still is some negotiating room with that, although the 25% tariff is kicking in really quick. So India will be feeling that right away, and that's going to also have a huge hit on Indian exports. China's situation right now, it's interesting. It's out there. India and China are kind of in the same boat. They both buy a ton of oil from Russia, and we could turn around and say 50% or 100% tariffs on Chinese goods coming to the U.S. I don't know exactly why the White House hadn't said this. I'm having to assume because of the tariff negotiations going on with China that maybe there's enough momentum in those that they didn't want to upset the apple cart. And I'm going to have to assume that the tariff negotiations with India, there's not enough momentum that they felt it was a good time to upset the apple cart. So that's kind of what we're seeing right now. The impact on the U.S., though, with massive tariffs of 50% or 100% would cause a lot of problems. Obviously, it'd be very inflationary. We buy a ton of goods that are produced from China, a lot of goods produced from India. so it'd have a tremendous inflationary effect. And you just saw, you know, the jobs report, even though, you know, the president fired the statistician that was in charge of it, the jobs report, which Wall Street and others are taking into account, was not great. And they're expecting the next one to not be as great either. So there are real reasons why the White House might be wanting to slow roll some of these things. Russia's oil revenue from oil and gas has really plunged recently, and that puts more pressure on Moscow to end this war, although Putin has a problem with that. I don't know if Putin has a way to end the war. Putin's got some serious problems. Now, in July, Putin's administration collected about and keep in mind the ruble is not the most stable currency, about 787 billion rubles, or it's about, I don't know, about $9.8 billion worth of oil and gas revenue. Again, that is 27% lower than what they had last year. Oil prices right now do not favor Russia at all. Oil prices are down. Production, there was seemed to be a reluctance of Saudi Arabia and some OPEC countries of increasing production. That has gone by the wayside. They don't seem to be having a problem with increasing production. And I think that everyone's kind of getting tired of what's happening on the global scene. And so Saudi Arabia, I think, sees some opportunities here. They see some real opportunities working with President Trump on some of these things. So I think what they're seeing is a chance that if they can get oil production up, if they can potentially supplant that Russian oil sales for a period of time, that that could be a real revenue earner for Saudi Arabia. So I think they're seeing something that could come from that. And also production from the U.S. I would point out that we just cut a deal with the European Union. I think it was like $750 billion, $250 billion a year over 3 years where they're going to buy liquefied natural gas coming from the U.S. That's significant, although I would point out I think they're already buying close to $200 billion a year. So it looked like a really good bumper sticker. But the difference between what they are buying and what they plan to be buying wasn't really as significant as a lot of people think. But it's still appreciable. And I don't want to take away from it. I think that's a big thing. But it does show a roadmap. It shows an alternative to getting natural gas, an alternative for getting oil. The U.S. has a ton of oil and shale. We can always fleet up our production on that. I mean, there's limits on everything. But we could actually export more oil. So there's a chance for the U.S. to make a lot of money as a gas and oil producing country exporting it around the world. Gosh, what a difference 20-some years makes. You know, I can remember after 9/11, we had a rather bleak picture of where the U.S. was in gas and oil, and now it's completely changed. What would happen to Russia? Its oil revenues would just dry up. They all of a sudden, they'd be in a position where they literally can't afford to pay for the war. And I'll talk more about that. And it looks like right now, and this sounds kind of strange, despite all the tension and everything with Modi and India, it looks like Trump is trying to kind of play India as a, dare I say it, Trump card, basically trying to use India as a way to put phenomenal pressure on Putin, pressure that Putin is really not set up politically, I think, to absorb. Putin is losing about 1,000, depends on which day you catch it, somewhere between 800 plus to sometimes up to 2,000 plus soldiers a day. It is phenomenal losses for very marginal gains on the battlefield. He thinks he's winning. He sees gains on the battlefield, and they are. They're making some marginal gains. They're actually gaining more territory than they're losing, although in certain areas they do lose territory. I want to point that out. His immediate goal, and it's been talked about this, is he might be satisfied with a ceasefire or some sort of truce, and I put that in quotes because I'm not sure that he would ever stop his war ambitions, but getting the four-hole velocity isn't completely control. You know, the Donetsk area, I should say the Donbass area with Luhansk, Donetsk, Oblast, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, he would like to control all of those. And if he did, he could then turn around and say, these are the areas where they had the referendum. They voted that they wanted to be Russia. That was all a fake vote, but that's another issue. And there, see, it was all worth it because we secured this, although his ultimate goal of taking over all of Ukraine never really goes away. He would just have to put that on the back burner for a while. So for him, whatever comes out of this, it's not an end. It's probably, to his mind, an end of the beginning of what he wants to do. His economy is headed for stagflation. It's headed for recession. It could turn into a massive depression. There's just a lot of things going wrong. And I know everybody's been predicting economic death bells, but he's somehow been able to circumvent with his shadow fleet and everything, being able to sell oil. If he can't sell oil, though, to India and China, then he's got massive, massive problems. Now, if the war ends, he's got massive problems there, too. He's completely the economy has completely changed over to a war economy. The economy is about building weapons, building bombs. That's what it does. It's a war economy. He doesn't have an easy way to change that around. There is no alternative economy he can immediately go back to. He can't turn swords into plowshares. There's just no way he's going to do that. He'll also end up with a bunch of very disgruntled, in many cases, very questioning of the government authority, Putin himself, troops, war-grizzled veterans who are really not happy. And they may not have been tactically great troops on the front lines, but they could be a big threat on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg. They would be flooding home. Defense industry workers would eventually have to be laid off. And again, there's no corresponding economy. The sovereign wealth fund, if you will, that piggy bank thing, has been vastly depleted. And there is a lot of dissatisfaction. You just don't see it because it's really tough to take polls in Russia. But there's a lot of frustration within Russia. And I do see the seeds of certainly 1917 and 1991 very much in play that Putin would be looking at if he didn't have this thing to keep pointing to. So I think he's going to keep pointing to this. All right. Would it be a social uprising like we saw before? I will say this. There is there's that famous saying that a dictator always looks invincible until the last 5 minutes. That's kind of Putin. I think everyone will believe that Putin is going to survive until just suddenly he's not there anymore. Kind of reminds me a little bit like Gorbachev. You know, you really didn't see Gorbachev and the Soviet Union completely going away until they were just suddenly gone. And everyone was shaking their heads. So that's an issue. And look, I got to tell you what Europe sees. Europe's very cautious about what type and the U.S. should be very cautious of what type of ceasefire or whatever is coming out of this. Because Putin has a reason to keep the production going, the war production, even if it completely depletes his financial reserves. But if he does that, he has to make gains somewhere. He's going to find someplace else. And for him, politically, it may be worth risking a war with NATO. I think he wants to finish what he did in Ukraine. I think he's very much made clear he's looking at the Baltic states. He's looking at other places. He wants to keep this going. Now, interesting, China is sitting on the other side. They're still angry about what happened with Siberia back in the 19th century. They'd like to get that back. And I think that he knows that. He knows that they've been looking at Siberia for quite some time. We're all focused on China doing this massive amphibious operation to take over Taiwan. Meanwhile, Putin has moved all of the Far East military, or not all, but he's moved a preponderance of the Far East military stuff to fight this war in Ukraine. Historically speaking, China, it's an unprecedented opportunity for them to literally just roll in and occupy Siberia, and that's vast wealth in terms of natural resources, reserves, space for the Chinese population, everything. So I think Putin realizes that as well. And hence my term, Putin's predicament. He's in a real predicament. If he does what we want him to do now, he could lose very quickly politically. If he declares peace in Ukraine without anything to really, without what he wants to show, if he has not achieved his goals, that undermines him politically in the Russian system dramatically and makes his position very perilous indeed. He's got a predicament. If he keeps going, well, he could be fighting in the West and losing in the East. His friendship with no bounds with China, well, there's something that he needs to look at there with that friendship with no bounds. China has interests, national interests. National interests that do not correspond to Russia's national interests. So he's got a predicament. And hence, that's why I call this Putin's predicament. Thanks for listening to Strat. Also, please go to stratpodcast.com. You can go to YouTube with Hal Kempfer TV. You can always go to the GRIPSA website, GRIPSA.com. And thanks for tuning in, and hopefully you'll turn into the next one.